Hey, Jamie, I've got a question for you.
What do you want, Tom?
Who's on the podcast this coming Friday? Is it someone big?
Boy.
Is it a big one? Shall I bother listening this week?
Yeah. If I was going to say take.
And I would say off.
No.
Your trousers.
No, no. Take.
Me out.
No. Take.
Paddy McGuinness.
No. Take.
Take on me.
Take that.
Wow.
Have a little patience.
But hang on, presumably you haven't got all three of them, have you? Presumably you've just got one of them.
Buddy, we have all three of them on the podcast. They've released a new album. It's coming out. They're going on tour. They talk about the ups, the downs, the lefts, the rights, on everything that happened in Take That.
The ins, the outs.
And they reveal it all this Friday.
Exclusively.
On Private Parts.
That's a big one. I'm going to listen to that.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
What's going on, everybody? It's your boy, Hussein Manawar, the original mummy's boy, Ilford's finest, the wizard of the East End, and I am joined by two of my very special friends, both who are leading change and experts in their field. Firstly, what can I tell you about this young man? He is born and bred in East London, right in Shoreditch, actually. I actually want to buy his property off of him, but he will never actually sell it to me. That's why I'm actually low-key friends with him, because he lives right in the heart of the city. He's a young actor from a working-class background. Nothing was ever given to him. He went out and got absolutely everything that he's working towards. He was the lead in 2 seasons of the BAFTA award-winning show Wolf Blood for the BBC and in Emmy award-winning programme Genius Picasso with Antonio Banderas, produced by Oscar winner Ron Howard for NatGeo/Fox. He's now venturing into the world of directing with his first play coming up at the Tristan Bates Theatre called Syndrome. We're going to soon get into that. He low-key has bars as well that I know that he's never told people about, but I know he's been spitting secretly in his bedroom for years. It is Jack Brett Anderson, everybody!
Hey! What's going on?
You good?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thank you for having me, Hussein.
No, thank you for being here.
That's
and
a pleasure.
Then we have Yamin Chowdhury. I had the pleasure of meeting Yamin via email, where I accidentally spelt his name wrong, and then I was firmly told to never do that again. And that was the start of a great friendship. I remember emailing him from a mutual friend called Jermaine Jackman, who I've not actually seen in years, by the way. Have you seen Jermaine?
Jermaine's good, man.
I've not seen Jermaine in years. He won The Voice, and now he's into politics, changing the world. And I said to Yamin, I have this idea, I want to help set a Guinness World Record. Yamin is an award-winning arts practitioner with a background in inclusion and community-led theatre. Prior to this, he was running arts and cultural organisations across UK and in Australia and China. Yamin has produced an array of groundbreaking initiatives, including the world's largest mental health lesson. We have incredible history together where we've gone up, down, left, right, successfully achieved things and also failed many things along the way as well. Yamin is in the building with us today. What's going on?
Come on.
Let's go get it.
What are you saying? You know what's crazy?
Go on.
I've only known you about 3 years.
But we've done so much together.
The amount of memories we've created in that time, good and bad, is nutty.
Well, let's start with the good.
Okay.
So I remember I first emailed you saying I have this idea about bringing the world's largest mental health lesson to Hackney. And at a time, no theatre would ever email me back. No one was trying to open their doors, give me the space or utilise anything. I didn't know anything about corporate relationships or funding or arts council
or
nothing. Yeah, yeah. I was just like, bro, I've got this idea. I really want to educate young people in theatre because I think it's engaging. What do you think? He was like, cool, let's go.
So this is the one you did at Hackney Empire?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there, I remember.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you were there as well. Oh my God,
I was actually there and I remember all of that. Yeah, I brought my uncle suffers mental health and
your uncle was in the front row.
Yes, and his experience was incredible. Like, he honestly felt a part of something bigger than he ever thought he was because of that.
Wow.
And even now we talk about it, we always ask how you are and how he just looked around and felt that he was accepted at that place.
Wow.
And there was more young people there than old people.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
As it were.
It was an amazing moment in time.
Definitely. And Maya Jama was the host. Yes. Incredible. Jordan Stevens was there as well, whose podcast I'm taking over. Jack was there. Yeah. Jada Caesar was there. It was on Good Morning Britain. It got great support from everybody.
King's College was a massive part of it.
And Samaritans as well. Professor Tilwack. Shout out Tilwack.
Yeah. But to touch back on what you started this story with is that other theatres don't email you back. I guess this is something that we're going to talk about more.
100%.
It's about, that's half the issue. Mm-hmm. It's because this landscape and sector look so alike all the time that there's no stretch. This offer has become homogenous and the same. So actually we need to lead in terms of ensuring that all sorts of conversations are being had. So even though you called me the wrong name when you first emailed me, which I think is just rude, even though you did that, there was that sense that, okay, there's this guy here who's got this idea that could be incredible. Mm. What can we do with it?
But also, what I think is great about you, though, some people take offence to the name being spelt wrong or called wrong.
I did.
Most certainly did. Uh-huh. Everyone I introduced him to, I'm like, please don't get his name.
But furthermore, like that being said, you still saw the goodness in what he was trying to achieve and move forward. Some people would take that thing, oh, you can't pay attention to namings. What else are you going to get wrong along the way?
I do think that there's a certain element of truth in that, though, because for me, that kind of fact-checking and that understanding that people have different qualities. Mm-hmm. So if you're called David or Jack or something like that, it's more understandable, particularly within the arts and culture landscape. So my name has 5 letters in it. Y-A-M-I-N. Mm-hmm. Don't add any, don't take any away, don't assume anything, because I always double check that. But similarly, I'm not going to hold it against somebody who just makes a mistake. But I do think that that's part of diversifying the landscape, is being more empathetic and sympathetic and understanding, actually, I do need to check this and make sure that it's spelled right. And
the attention to detail is so key.
100%. And making sure that our community feels like a community.
And also our community and our job demands attention to detail. Because when you're doing a show or writing something or film, TV, you need to make sure what you're putting in there, one, correlates with everything else and also actually makes sense.
Yeah, 100%.
Because you're representing someone somewhere. And if your attention to detail isn't there, you're going to miss something and then have the wrong message.
100%. You
know? I think that's so really key.
Let's go back to that Guinness World Record attempt, because Hackney Empire, I mean, I know it for Russell Brand. I know it for like some really key, notable entertainers. Mm-hmm. Like it is such an historical venue. It's got so much culture and life. And when you got that email, how was that for you? And where did your vision come from about seeing this mental health lesson come to life in your theatre?
It just made sense because I don't believe in luck, but I definitely believe you make luck. You make your own luck. And you create. And part of that was that the reason when you had this idea, and you met Jermaine at your TED talk, right? Is that right?
I met Jermaine a few times. I remember I heard him sing first.
Okay.
And I was like...
Yeah, Jermaine. Shout out Jermaine Chapman.
When he sings...
It's
just another world.
Do you know Jermaine?
Get transported into another world.
But the reason that... Whenever you spoke to Jermaine about it, the reason that he would have thought of me quickly, I hope, is that I have a history of trying to enable that kind of work that is transformative, that's going to change how people feel about themselves or their environment or their society or stretch them. So for me, it was just standard. All right, cool. There's this guy who called Hussein. I kind of did a little bit of research on you. You clearly knew what you were talking about.
Yeah, of course, my shit's popping. Let's be real. Let's be real now.
But yeah, so I knew that you had this.
He always knocks me back.
Someone's got to.
Trust me. But yeah, so I knew you had this thing and you had this ability and this drive and passion. And what you had spoken to me about was that all it needed was some shape to be able to make it producible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Hackney Empire, and people make this mistake about theatre all the time, that it's this space that you can just walk into cold and have this dream and it will just come to life magically. Yeah. And
I definitely thought that.
Yeah, and you kind of disregard all the shape it takes, which is what you were commenting on about earlier, and all the people's brains that it takes to make these things a reality. So I knew that with a little bit of work with you...
You could have structured that for him. And
absolutely.
Life,
and make it work. And then, you know what? If it doesn't do what we want it to do, it's still worth doing.
Yeah.
Because the ambition of the project and what it wanted to achieve was important.
Yeah.
And the message was bigger than the actual function.
Yeah. So if you do that with 1,300 people or 13 people, actually it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
As a first step, let's just make this mark. Let's plant a flag in the ground and just keep the ball rolling from there, which is basically what we've been trying to do for the last few 100%.
Years. 100%. All right, brilliant. And just sticking on the concept of diversity for now, Hackney Empire is one of the most diverse theatres, I believe, in London. Mm-hmm. How do you think Hackney did that?
It's been doing it. Empire is 120 years old next year, and it was built in 1901 to bring theatre to the people instead of expecting people to go to the theatre.
Yeah,
that's why it's not in the West End. Mm, that's why it exists in an area like Hackney, was to make sure that this thing, this nexus for ideas and experimentation was accessible.
Wow.
So it's been doing that. It just so happened that when it was reopened in 1985 by Roland and Claire Muldoon and that company of people, they understood the importance of equity and diversity. I hate diversity as a word now because I think it's so loaded. But they did diversity not to tick boxes
but to
on a funding application, because that wasn't a priority for anybody then, but because they understood the landscape that Hackney Empire sat in. The ecology of the people and communities around that. And they wanted it to be owned by its people.
Yeah. Creatively and managementally, everything just going on
so
by,
when
by
I,
the people.
I also just want to say, when
we did the Guinness World Record, Hackney Empire, they were the first and only venue to offer the space at no cost.
But that's its ethos then, essentially. Do you know what I mean?
Like, imagine that.
What was needed, there's no cost on that. It's like, for me, like healthcare, there should be no cost on that. Mm-hmm. Anywhere. Like the budget should always be in place for healthcare, you know, or food or water or schooling. It's the same with that. Like there should be certain things that come under a quota where it's like the world needs to hear this.
Yeah.
People need to see this, or they're being deprived of this.
Yeah.
So why are we putting money on it? That's like a concept. You know? And I think the fact that Hackney Empire came back with... we don't want to charge you money. This is something that we've always wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that mental health there.
But Hackney Empire caught me when I was 18. It was my safety net. Do you know what I mean? So I can't take credit for it having this incredible representation in all parts of the organisation, including what's on stage. But it's all of our jobs. I'm just a custodian at this point in time. Hackney Empire is not mine. I just have to make sure that it's not only available, but ambitious and an incredible resource for his community into the future.
Yeah, but I think your passion of consistently pushing out events like Alter Ego, getting these big headliners to come down and really engage with the young people. I remember I found Shifa K, who's an incredible poet.
Shout out Shifa. Yeah. You need to get her in this.
I want to do an episode with all poets on here as well, because I think that energy will be crazy. And I remember I met Shifa K at Hackney Empire. She got on stage and she drops this one line of talking about Love Island, but how are you finding love on an island? And it just hit me so hard. And then from there, she ended up supporting my Jazz Cav show.
Yeah,
I remember
that was beautiful.
Yeah, it was
beautiful.
And my audience had never seen someone like Shifa K. Mm-hmm. Not only that, forget that I had never seen someone like Shifa K. This young...
Do you know the maddest bit? When Shifa came to Hackney Empire, she auditioned for a show around...
But yeah, how do you get someone young through your door?
Well, that's the entire approach. That's how you talk about arts and culture as a thing. Do you know what I mean? Because we talk about it in our circles, Jack. I'm saying our circles here. As this incredible highbrow, middle class, bougie concept. But arts and culture, there's this crazy, I went to this meeting, I'm not going to say who it was with, because I'm not going to hot anybody up, but they said, they gave this incredible statistic saying something like 35% of Londoners aren't involved in arts and culture whatsoever. And when you hear that, you go, fucking hell, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But you telling me that 35% of people don't listen to any music? They don't watch any TV?
I was just about to say that, I think you'll find they actually are more involved than you ever realised.
Yeah. Of course.
Going to the cinema.
But our circle, are this very niche little special
world.
Group, doesn't classify what they interact with as arts and culture. That's nonsense.
Yeah. But people play also games, you know what I mean? The Pokemon stuff on their phones.
100%,
That's art and culture. Yeah. Someone sat and designed those characters and put that together and coded it. Like, I don't think people really know the full extent of art and culture.
When that Pokemon Go game came out, we had people, because Hackney Empire became one of them, the main spots. They were coming and healing their thing or whatever it was.
trying to find a Pikachu.
Trust me, but you know what? Some of them actually turned into customers. Some of them are who actually, you know, they were just wandering around.
So it feeds into itself, right?
Yeah.
This is the stretch.
But did they purposely plant those feeding stations at the Hackney Empire, so it brought young people to the theatre.
Oh, maybe, we don't know.
But maybe the thing that we should be thinking about in terms of how to geotag things that bring people about to be in the environment to see things. But I just come up with that now in my head. Because
that's all about diversifying. You're talking about how do you get young people into theatre. It's about what does that offer look like?
Yeah. Usual
and
mediums.
At the minute, the offer all looks the same.
Yeah.
So it's the same type of people who go into it.
Yeah, the reason why I asked this is because I'm a big fan of art and culture. I'm a big fan of drama and theatre, acting and everything. And I genuinely believe when I was growing up, I believe my generation, I'm 28 now, was the best of the last, I shall say, in terms of the quality of childhood we had. Mm. We was outside in the fields. We was hopping fences.
Making camps.
We was building forts.
Going
we
up
was,
into trees.
Exactly. We was breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah. Well,
we
I'm was opening fire hydrants.
I never did that.
You don't do that.
No, but no, but listen, but we're breaking the fourth wall and we're finding expression.
Yeah.
We're not growing up on social media. We're not exploring on the explore page. Yeah. And I genuinely believe the art and the arts and culture helps your mental health massively. It aids you in so many ways. And Jack, I want to talk to you now. Mm. Like you mentioned earlier, your uncle suffers from mental health issues. He came to the world record attempt that we did where we was trying to educate and engage people. When did your introduction come into the world of acting? Mm. And then when did you see this is actually helping your mental health?
Well, I think that like all of us have our stories. Do you know what I mean? And when I came into acting, it was when I was 12. Because, you know, like home life for me then wasn't easy. Like I didn't want to go back. So whatever would keep me at school or out of the house was the best thing for me. So like I was doing drama, so you rehearse late, and then I was an army cadet, so I'd sometimes leave then and go army cadets and train there. It was just something that distracted me.
Yeah.
But art for me was like I wanted to talk to people about what I was upset about, but I didn't want them to know I was going through that, so they didn't judge me. So then when I was doing performing, it was like I can just get it out this way and no one know that's my issues, sort of thing. So for me, almost immediately I realized that it was a release that I needed. Because it was just like, I was too young to like find it. It just kind of came to me.
Where'd you grow up?
Poplar, East London.
Oh, wow.
I school in the Isle of Dogs. George Green.
I told you I want that property.
But, you know, it was one of them. So for me, it was like, young. It was just in school. I was never, it wasn't the lead in the shows, but I was in it. You know, wanted one of the T-Birds. Even though I couldn't sing well, I would still just try my best. Yep. But that was a form of releasing that 100%. Little bit of energy
and
in some way.
What part of the exercising of acting do you enjoy the most?
I mean, for me, I didn't really like the theory side of it when I was younger.
Yeah.
But as I've grown older, I've found what's important about that because it brings the nutrients and the minerals for the actual performance.
Yep.
But for me, it was the releasing, like the being in a full heated emotional or a heroic moment within a play.
Yeah.
That release was like euphoric, I suppose, like coming off stage after 1,500 people screaming at you and you're giving them something and you're on this kind of weird high. That high is what I think is, it made me feel safe and excited.
That's beautiful.
In a way.
When and I can be life-changing.
Well, I mean, 10 years, 15 years on, I'm still doing what I love.
And not only for you, but how does your uncle feel when he now sees it? Because you live with your uncle, right?
Yeah, he lives with me now. So my grand passed in 2016, and you know, it was either him to life. You know, you have to find a way to move forward always. But it was either he goes to the street or he moved in with me, and there's just something in my heart that couldn't allow that.
Mm-hmm.
But to be honest with you, I used to find him quite annoying and difficult before I understood.
Yep.
And when I actually found a way to communicate with him, because he would get very flustered or anxious, and then with that, his speech impediment would come about. So he then get frustrated himself and turn to anger. So actually, it was this kind of cycle of he can't get out of this, unless you give him the space to get out of it. So it was me like calming him down, asking him a question, and I'd be like, you ain't gonna answer right now. Just come back to me in 5 minutes. And he'll come back and have a full sentence, a full conversation.
Yeah,
but in the moment of asking, or me asking him, it's very like difficult. I'm like, and it was anxiety starts to build in the room because you're almost like, you're wasting my time. Like, I've got to go. But then, really and truly, it's the full experience that I had of being around someone that just doesn't have the ability.
Wow.
To do how you do it. So for me, living with him at first was difficult, and I felt like it was a chore. But in fact, it fed my creativity, it fed my understanding, it fed my ability to be compassionate even more.
And your empathy.
And my empathy within the work that I started to do and within the way I would interact with other people. It just opened my mind. It was a forced thing, that almost a pressure cooker that brought out the better version of the scenario than the worst, you know.
Mm.
So in a way, it was
But that's something you've worked on.
Yeah, I had. There was a part of my soul because of my love for my nan. You got to get through this. You got to find, because you can do it. Like 2 minutes of effort for me doesn't take much, but 2 minutes of effort from him is a completely different story. So me applying those 2 minutes to helping someone was so much more effective and goes so much further than leaving someone that just can't really do it to do it themselves.
That's a beautiful thing,
you know.
And I was searching online, and this question is for both of you, really. I was searching online, and it basically, I found an article online that said actors are more likely to suffer from depression than more people, than the general public.
Yeah.
Mainly because of job insecurity, performance anxiety, what to do when you're not working, getting an audition. You wait all this time to get an audition, and then you get told no, or you don't really get told no, you just don't get told anything. Yeah. Or you shoot something and you don't know when it's coming out, and then...
Or it gets cut.
Exactly. There's so many ways in which this story can go. It's never straightforward. No. So what self-care tips do you apply to yourself? And what self-care tips... Because you... I mean, I've been in Hackney Empire.
Yeah.
I've spent a lot of time there. You just need to stand there for a day to see the amount of people with ambition that are flying through the door.
Yeah.
What do you do and what do you say to them people to help them manage their mental health better? So whoever wants to go first.
Just a little quick summary. I think that one thing I've kind of learned is that remaining confident in the quiet times is key. So like, it's not by not waiting and doing nothing in the quiet times, it's waiting and doing something, working on yourself, working on your craft. And is what happens, the time you're busy goes by quicker than you realize, and you're on to the next stage of what you should be doing. Same with like when you get a victory, you get win one job, you can't be celebrating that one job. Because once you celebrate the one job you just got on that moment, the energy that got you the job that meant to go somewhere else, you miss it by partying and celebrating. So like small victories, you know, don't celebrate the ultimate goal, you know, like being an Olympian, like, you know, you're aiming for the fourth year. You're not aiming for this, the world championships or regionals. You want to go to Olympics. So I think if the mindset of what, if the real reason as to why anyone's doing it in industry is because they love it, they want to explore art, conversation, difference, and bring it together and inform or educate, like, you won't, the insecurities don't really seep in because you're constantly building towards something. It's not just a shift job.
It's not a sprint.
It's not a sprint. It's a constant, you have to constantly moving towards whatever it is, because stories constantly grow, your day changes, your day should inspire you, your interactions, your conversations, your mistakes, you know, all of those things. So it's remaining confident in why you're doing what you're doing in the quiet times that allow you to be confident always. And that's something that I've had to find, because I think actors think that, or anyone thinks the industry is this thing, you step into it, because you're stepping into it, it happens for you. I would say that it's the complete opposite. It's one of the toughest industries in the world. You know, you can get a degree, but you may never work.
Yeah, it's true.
But it's still about finding what it is creatively you want to express and put across there, why you're being an artist in that way.
And reminding yourself of that.
Right?
You know, 100%.
And I think that could be in poetry, in music, in art, acting, in
it's very
artistic directing, like, however it may be, like, it's about just constantly growing within that realm and moving forward. So I would say, you know, remain confident in the quiet times by doing what you love and makes you grow, so time doesn't seem like a thing waiting around, you know.
I think that's really, really good advice. For me, it boils down to education. I think that we have to make our, particularly our young artists, but all artists, more resilient to the realities of the sector. And
how do you do that, though?
Well, you have to set them up with realistic expectations early. I think a lot of people, particularly young people, you go from secondary school or college or whatever and into drama academies or wherever you go, whatever your journey is, and you're set up with this unrealistic expectation of actually what is achievable and in what time frame that is achievable.
But the only example they get is the star.
Of course.
Which is A-list. So of course. And the idea is that there is a whole journey of levels of success or stardom or whatever it
and
may be.
And demons and trials and tribulations.
But nobody talks about that.
No.
Yeah. Nobody talks about that, particularly with an educational
So what does it look like, right? So I'm a young person. I've come to Hackney Empire. I'm now involved in a program. I've got a mentor. So how does it work? Like where in the program do you begin to inject the realities?
From the first meeting. From the first meeting, you
without,
don't...
Without, like, damaging their ambition.
There's a difference between being ambitious and dreaming unrealistically. And we know that in areas like Hackney, in areas like Tottenham, where I come from, you're less likely to encounter the type of success that some of your peers are. You just are, depending on your background, your gender, your race, your culture. There, all these factors start to play in that. And so really, our idea of success in terms of working with young people specifically is trying to equip them with as much information and widen and broaden their perspective on what the industry can do for them and what they can do for the industry to the extent where they can gig, at least.
Yeah, and they become self-sustainable.
Well, you can... Listen, being self-sustainable in the arts and culture industries is a whole different conversation. Yeah. But, you know, if you are not, you know, the lead in a play or in a TV show or whatever, that you can gig around and hopefully we can help you pay your bills.
Yeah.
Hopefully we can help you pay your rent and put food on the table.
Yeah. And I think with that is really defining what success is, right? Because 100%. I think a lot of people compare success, but if we wake up every day and we can eat, live where we are, do what we love doing, right? If you are doing that and then you are growing and adding to yourself, naturally what you're doing will become really good work.
Absolutely.
And that really good work will then bring you on to what you see these A-listers or however it may be, easy reference point of what that is. And it comes from hard work, determination. And most people you see in those positions, some of the nicest people I've ever met. And it's because they really do love what they do and what they're doing. And it has come through years of dedication. And, you know, they've done some little things like Bruno Mars, for example. The guy was writing songs for everyone else for so long, you know. And the one
I
song,
didn't even know that.
Yeah, for so long. He was here in London recording, and the billionaire song he wrote with Travis McCoy, it was him just really wishing, and it, the one thing that was really wanted, he wrote, and it became the hit that allowed him to be known. So it's like bearing your soul, being truthful.
Yeah.
Like, it's so hard to like bear your flaws and like be open about them. So when you do find people that actually do it, they're the most endearing and most intriguing because they're connecting with something real with you. And that's when you get those people. But it comes from the quiet time, the hard work, not doing it to be there, because that is doing it for
and
that.
And that's where social media is super problematic.
Yes.
Particularly in industries like this, where you only see the highlights.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We spoke about this in episode one with regards to vulnerability and the beauty of being vulnerable. We didn't actually touch upon the pressures and social effects and psychological effects of social media. So that's really interesting because I have a time limit on my phone of 1 hour per app. And I think that's too long. So like as soon as an hour's up on Instagram, it's closed for 24 hours. As soon as it's up for Twitter, it's closed. Everything, WhatsApp included, is just done. Because I believe that is still a long amount of time to be looking at a screen. But not only are you just looking at a screen, you begin to compare yourself. You begin to affect your own self-esteem because all of a sudden, Jack's doing amazing things and I'm still in bed. Or Yamin's doing mad, crazy auditions and I haven't even brushed my teeth today.
Mm.
And all of that is really problematic. But I wanted to touch upon both of you are very successful in what you do. And one thing I know from both of you, you work all the time.
Mm.
You work very, very hard. How do you find a work-life balance for your own mental health? And how do you keep that at ease as well and remind yourself that you aren't just an actor or an artistic director, but you're also a partner, a friend, a brother?
I don't have a healthy work-life
really?
Balance. No.
No, I appreciate the honesty.
I really don't.
I see him in Hackney Empire late. And like, I went to watch the pantomime, and the pantomime there is incredible. And I was like, oh, are you enjoying the show? He's like, I'm working.
Okay, see you in a bit.
I don't know how to do it any different. And this is very much a case of do as I say, not as I do. In order for me to break through the sector, I had to grind. And I had to hustle every given opportunity.
And more time than anyone else was doing, right?
Yeah, I had to do twice the work to get half the recognition.
Yes.
That was my kind of burden. Yeah. And it's very isolating and it's very... difficult at times, and I guess earlier in my career, these weren't conversations that were being commonly heard about well-being and
you mental just get health. With it, right?
Yeah, you just isolation. How do you deal with that?
Well, arts is a different thing because on your own, you're surrounded by people.
Yes,
all the time.
Yes, I agree. So,
you're kind of on this island and you're just doing your thing.
It's art.
But you
island.
Don't feel alone because you've got all these people around
you. But then when this director's rap and it's cut, we're done, last show finished, everyone go their own way. How do you handle that?
But this, I think this is where people need to like zoom out. And like once you zoom out, you look at the bigger picture and you have to go, this was a time period that I got to do this. What have I got from this? Now let's go on to the next thing. And next thing, be it your next day, even, okay, let me do something different the next 2 days. Let's go running and do this, have dinner with my grandma or whatever. So you just kind of find yourself tuning back into the day, because that is it's a compartmentalizing it. Like you have to be emotionally intelligent to like somewhat even be in the arts.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
It's a bit personal, you don't need to answer.
No, go on, yeah.
Have you ever been therapy?
No.
Because what you're talking about is what I learned at therapy. I went to cognitive behavioral therapy.
Oh, right.
And it was all about being able to compartmentalize.
Maybe I should go.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's very interesting because it's all about being able to compartmentalize your thoughts.
Seize control of your emotions,
and,
right?
Yeah, and not let, for example, if I have a bad audition or a play didn't go the way it goes, to affect my situation at home.
Yes.
My situation at home is completely different to my car needing a new tire.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where I feel like for me, I was in a downward spiral because I would link everything to each other. Yeah. And I had to learn to separate them.
Well, remember, we're emotional. We are constantly emotional. I could do one scene here and then, for example, I could be in a raging moment and something goes wrong and it has to stop the scene. And you're like, that was the take though.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't go get a grip of your emotions and start again, but if I let my emotions go wild where they already are, wiry and so on, anything could come of that and then it could be very damaging.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you have a healthy work-life balance?
I think that like...
Boy, no you don't. You call me in the middle of the night with your ideas. Why are you lying?
Well, that's because I'm passionate, you know what I mean? I love it. And if an idea comes, you have to... I believe if you get a thought or a moment, it's not you, it's the universe giving it to you, you know, in a weird way. And you have to act on it. There's times where I've got these thoughts and I'm not acting on it, and then in the morning it's gone.
Yeah.
And I am, for a week, I'm like, I can feel it.
Yeah.
I just don't know what it was. So now I've started to, but that come time though, over time I started to realise what was necessary, what was needed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't go on a lad's boys holiday until I was 28, 2019.
Wow, for last year.
Because I worked in Sainsbury's night shift, at Abercrombie working, PAing, just because I knew what I had to do to keep going in the early years. So I had some money just to audition. You know, I didn't have that privilege. Oh yeah, mum, dad.
That's the thing about work-life balance, especially early. How can we really talk to people about work-life balance when really what we're saying is your auditions aren't paying you? The first 10 auditions, you'll be lucky if you land one out of the first 25. You're lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we're saying is do Sainsbury's.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did Sainsbury's.
Baker,
I was in Baron John and Seats.
But doesn't that make all of us who we are though? Like how can I possibly play someone who's worked in a supermarket? I've never had the experience. How can I be a medic if I've never been a first aider?
No, I don't agree with that.
But you should want to explore that.
100%. You should want to.
It shouldn't be, that's not good enough for me. It should be, let me try that.
That's our perspective on it. Well, I think if you look at the sector, you see a lot of people who can afford not to get paid.
Word. No, you're right. Yeah.
You can afford not to get paid, but also you can afford not to necessarily see direct, tangible career progression for a certain amount of time. You can just sit still and explore your opportunities and then let things land. Mm-hmm. And you can do that for a few years. And you've got people and network and finance to support that.
Yeah.
And that and what that's prohibitive to most people.
So why is it our backgrounds, and I might be generalizing all of us here, but why is it our backgrounds do not see the arts and culture sector of society as a viable career path?
Because realistically, it's not a viable career path.
No, it's not.
Yeah. You're not guaranteed.
Ain't that
a wage
the realest truth of the day?
It's not viable.
It's true.
Yeah, it's just not. It's something that is an anomaly.
So it's our families being like, you know what, we don't want you to go through the depression of that. We've seen what it's done to people. Yeah. Look at what it's done to your favourite actor. Look at what so we're trying to save
also, you from who's going to pay for your meal next week? Mm. You know, when if something goes wrong with mum and dad and you're still doing this. Like,
well, this is another interesting thing here because I have found recently one conversation that's never had by anyone is money well-being.
Yes, and you know what? I think this is so important for the industry to have some kind of introduction to this. We were talking about it with Mockdoor Media, like what we would like to do in terms of progressively bring people to a different space and different understanding, and that would be that how to manage your money. Like, yeah. How, for me, for example, I saved the Sainsbury's money night shift, mm-hmm. 10 hours, and I'll go to Abercrombie, I'll leave it at 6, get there for 8 till 12, and I'll live off that money. Mm-hmm. So I live off the Abercrombie money, but I saved the Sainsbury's.
But where did you learn that?
I just, army cadets. I was an army cadet. Army cadets taught me structure and discipline, yeah. And there's no I in team, and it's always us, and if you're strong as your slowest man, and all these mm-hmm. things here. So that was like, okay, cool, I've got a mission to do. I need to save that question majority, but I need to live minimally off that. And that was my plan.
Yeah.
I'm the opposite. I'm terrible.
Really?
I am.
Oh, I can be.
Why?
I was never trained or taught, and nor do I come from a place in the world where money has more value than the materials you can buy with the money. So the money is as valuable as what as I can purchase and what I can show out with.
Yeah.
And that is deeply ingrained in my DNA mm-hmm. because of... particularly I think growing up with not a lot, less than not a lot,
yeah.
As soon as I started making money, I wanted to have what I saw everybody else with.
But see, I was like, I've not had money, I don't want to lose it.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm not going to spend it.
Well, you know what, I'm a bit different. I'm a bit like you as well, but I had this conversation with my dad the other day, and I was trying to figure out, like, because my dad's a trained actor. Yeah. He went drama school, everything. But he's very supportive of what I do. So now, towards the later stages where he sees things happening, he's more inclined to push me. At the start, it was very difficult. I said to him the other day, I was walking up the stairs. I got in at 2:00 from a writing session. It sounds way more glamorous than it is. I was writing in my shed.
It's a nice shed, though.
I was writing in my shed and I was going to sleep. And I walked past his bedroom. I see he's still awake. So I'm like, you know what? Let me say something to him. I put my head in and I go, I work hard, you know, Dad, and you never say it to me. And he looks at me and goes, I work harder than you, and I don't go to the mountains to find myself when shit gets rough either.
That's so real. Go on, boss.
I was just like, okay, shit. I'm going to take that. And I took that, and then I turned away and I looked at my iPhone calendar and it said, Brecon Beacons this week. But I was like, my dad's generation, yeah. They didn't have these like luxuries of being able to be like, yo, Yamin, how's your mental health?
Yeah.
Do you need to go to a spa? Like, do you need a couple hours?
But this
like,
feeds back into what you were saying earlier when you said, why do people of our background not see art or see the because we didn't have time.
They didn't have
There was
the
no time in the day to that. It was like, you had to work, you had children, you had to live, you had to pay your bills, you had to do what, in fact, if you go tribal, everyone in every tribe way back when was busy within the tribe doing stuff.
Yeah.
Peeling through, dealing with materials, whatever it was. So now it's just become to a place where we've got a lot of luxury of time. And I think it's good that we have obviously art informing and stuff, but people from our backgrounds wouldn't have been as exposed to those things is because there just wasn't time.
There wasn't a lot.
Because oppressed by the environment.
I definitely do believe a lot more time creates space for a lot more opportunity. And when I look at a lot of, like, my dad was in some incredible things. He was in the Catherine Tate show. Nice. He did the BP petrol advert. He delivered Tiffany's.
You better get him on the show. He
delivered Tiffany's baby in EastEnders. But all as like as an extra, what they call. Like,
he delivered Tiffany's baby.
Back in the day,
that was a big thing.
Do you know what I grew up with? Do you know what we grew up in my house? Pause the TV because dad's going to be here any second. And we're pausing it. And that's what we grew up watching. And it was fascinating to see this man who, like, part-time sells samosa and kebabs. We have the best samosa in the world, by the way. And then all of a sudden, he's on TV. And he was always and only a supporting artist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he never had them opportunities. And not many Pakistani actors did.
Not
only more recently are we seeing people come through.
And doing things.
So, It's very interesting.
But it's also interesting what you said about your dad earlier when he came for you about going off to the mountains to relax.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember when I was younger and I didn't know my dad until I was 12, but when I first ever got in his car, he used to be like a semi-pro footballer, but he came from the same background as me, but really worked hard to get away from it. And he had this like 307 Peugeot, yeah? And I remember getting in there, it smelled nice. And I was like, oh, it smells really nice, Dad. It's like the second time I'm really meeting him. He went, you know what that is, son? I went, what? He went, hard work.
Mm.
And I was like, oh. He went, yeah. You want nice things, you have to work hard for them.
Yeah, you do have to
work hard. Don't get it confused. And I was like, I'm 28. I was 12. Never left. I think I've told that every day to someone I think is worthy of hearing it.
But you know, just quickly, going back to that work-life balance thing, I work extremely hard because I'm addicted to financial gain. Mm-hmm. I just am.
That's so honest of you to say that.
I can never go back to being poor. Yeah. That's not a position I'll put myself in. But... So I have money, but I don't necessarily have time to enjoy the money that I have.
Because you still want to.
Yeah. So the quick fixes, go and ASOS for a minute. Or, yeah. You know what I mean? Go and do something nice.
Retail therapy is a real thing. Apparently. It does make you happy.
I mean, because...
Yeah, but it's not therapy.
It's like the candy version of therapy. Yeah.
It's a drug. It's an addiction. It's like social media.
Yeah, it's the shallow end of it.
You dip your toe in, you get that rush of endorphins in your system. Mm. You come out. If you can't afford it, you have remorse. You feel worse afterwards. Mm. But the cycle continues. And then Instagram comes in and you see your bedroom. He's working some nice things. And you're like, so I need to show out the next time I go out.
I almost think having more money... brings about
more problems.
It's there forever, but like if you're in a position of more money and your need for art or job or career or family isn't as strong as the need to have been rich or whatever, I think you find the bigger problems because people have nothing to do. The drop from the adrenaline or the endorphins of where you have your first £1 million from your movie or whatever scene may be. Oh my God, it's here. And you think there's a way to live with it or there's stuff you should be doing because it's there. But in fact, you can have as much money as you want. But after a certain time, the threshold, you could have bought certain things, but you've gone past the human understanding of what that experience is to go through. And actually you end up going to some stupid ends of life because you have so much money, nothing to do with it. And you've got kind of fallen into this world where what's really important doesn't exist anymore because you don't have to worry. You know, the need to like keep life going forward kind of goes away. So it's interesting. I think there's few people in the world that you can come across that money doesn't mean nothing, and they're still 100%. Incredible people within their field. But money can, I think, too much money for anyone can be a self-destructive thing.
100%. I do agree with you. I would like to ask you guys a question. What can we do as a society to encourage more work and more things to be done within the artistic space for young people? Because it's clear, it is an undeniable fact, mental health is aided and healed through the arts. Like, it might not solve all your problems, but it will definitely teach you how to manage some through escapism, therapy.
Informing.
Exactly, all of that learning, storytelling. So what can we as a society do more to encourage more people to get into the arts at a time where funding, I mean, I don't know a lot about funding, but I'm always hearing arts funding is getting cut.
Yeah, but this all goes back to reframing what the whole thing means in the first place. So if you, arts and culture, again, it's this term that we just use. But if we just look at storytelling in the most basic way, all right? Storytelling, a good story, it has a point, it has a purpose. You don't tell the story for the sake of telling it. You tell it to communicate some kind of information, whether that be a moral story or some kind of journey story, whatever it is. And at that point, what blurs the line between theatre and the news? When you're trying to capture information and spread information as a resource, particularly those that don't have access to it, what is the difference? The stories that I have a purpose. So I won't put on shows at Hackney Empire because I feel like it's a good show. Mm-hmm. I need to know what are the objectives. And these are not secondary objectives, these are primary objectives. What are the purposes of these stories that we're trying to tell? And why are we trying to tell them? And who are we trying to tell them to?
Yeah.
And the issue with our young people, particularly in areas that it sounds like we all come from, is that they have no exposure to this level of access.
Mm-hmm.
They have no opportunity, one, to be told stories, but two, to tell their stories.
Yeah.
And so what we have to do is really rethink the intrinsic value of access to this level of opportunity, just in terms of opening oneself up to being sympathetic to outside viewpoints and opinions and perspectives. Somebody said something really interesting to me the other day, where an opposing viewpoint is no longer interesting, it's offensive.
Wow, ain't that the truth?
And so all of these issues that we're seeing in front of us, you know, however you feel politically with what's going on right now, can all be boiled down to the fact that there's no openness in communication anymore. Mm-hmm. So if we want to change that, let's look at education, let's look at reforming these systems. Why did you not like drama? You just said the theory side of it. What the fuck is the point in the theory side of drama so early on? That's just off-putting. Let's just look at storytelling and exposing ourselves to more ideas.
Wait, he said something really interesting, and I think me and you are a great testament of this. Me and Jack have very blunt, open, honest conversations. So like, he lives in a predominantly Bengali area that has a lot of Bengalis and a lot of white people. from completely different cultures. They don't really ever clash.
No.
They never really ever clash. But we do sit in your house and we have blunt, honest conversations about why members of
this community does this or this does that, and why should that be okay? If the point of view is different, then surely you should understand how that comes across and why that does cause continued efforts.
But not everyone's like that.
No,
that's what you just said. People take offense, but that's a whole nother conversation.
That's a whole nother thing. But I'm saying we, in our relationship as friends, we've found that place where we can speak bluntly, and it's not a white person saying it to someone else vice versa. It's just two people discussing the difference that causes the misunderstandings or the problems we may face in a very
and
mixed
that's why I think real. Like, I hate the word influencers, but I feel like real influencers should be discussing them type of things.
Yes.
All right, Jack, tell us about Syndrome.
Okay, so Syndrome is a play that's going to be on at Tristan Bates Theatre, Covent Garden, from the 18th to the 29th of February. And it follows four soldiers in the first Gulf War in 91.
Yep. And I just want to say, you're losing your director's virginity here.
I am. Yep. Yeah, I'm popping that cherry.
Wow. You ain't never heard terminology like that before, have you?
I am ready to pop the cork in it and show people this story. And it follows the soldiers in Act 1 in Iraq discussing why they're there, what's going on. And 5 years later, you see the kind of where the characters are after what may have occurred. And it's called Syndrome because over 500,000 men, American and British, had come back from Iraq after 6 weeks with syndromes that weren't just PTSD and that were put off as that. Mm-hmm. They were memory loss, muscle deterioration, and burning semen, which means, you know, it's a very difficult life going forward.
Of course.
They weren't recognized. So I think this play has come around in a timely time, as it were, to kind of highlight what happens when we go to war and we don't need that anymore.
100%.
And also, in turn, to kind of just give some recognition to these people, I think, that feel a little bit forgotten. You know?
Amazing. And tickets are on sale right now.
Tickets are on sale right
I'll
now.
I'll be hosting a special question and answer session now.
Yes,
on
you will.
On the 18th
on the
of
18th,
February.
Yeah.
On the 18th of February.
I can't wait to have you there, bro.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm really excited to see what you've brought to life.
I can't
and
wait either.
Yamin, what is going on in your world? And I understand auditions are now open for Alter Ego.
Auditions are filled up for Alter Ego.
They're filled
auditions
already.
Are on the 25th. Show is on February 21st at Hackney Empire. If you want to come and see an Edwardian theatre getting taken over by 1,500 14 to 18-year-olds from East London celebrating grime and
Afrobeat
underground, the cream of the crop, the capital's underground. Come down to Alter Ego on February 21st. Otherwise, check out hackneyempire.co.uk. It is your theatre, not mine. Think globally, act locally. Come on.
I'll be there.
Yes, and that was episode 2 of the I'm Whole podcast with your boy. Listen, we need to get some Westwood horns up in this. I feel like that.
You need a soundboard.
You know, we do. And I definitely think, Yamin needs his own podcast.
Huh?
I definitely think that.
Do you know why I can't? Because I feel itchy already. Like, I can feel my leg is about to start tapping.
Yeah, but you
I
know what?
I want to run out of here.
I actually think you're quite a good voice to listen to.
100%.
Oh, God bless you guys.
I enjoyed
it's really
it.
Nice.
Oh, you need to learn how to take a compliment.
I can't. No, I can't. I'm taking my headphones off.
It's your boy, Hussein Manawa, the original Mummy's Boy, Ilford's Finest. And that is the end of episode 2 of the Whole Truth podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Powered by Spirit Studios.